Christine Schneider, the visceral voice.
Welcome to the Visceral Voice podcast. I'm your host, Christine Schneider. Through this podcast, I aim to bring you the most current, up-to-date research on voice science, function, pain science, movement, and everything in between. I am on a quest to learn everything I can about the living, breathing body and its intricate connection to the voice. This podcast documents the continuation of my learning and my experience as a professional singer, a nutritional consultant, a movement specialist, and a manual therapist. Join us as we strive to provide current, knowledgeable, creative, and compassionate information to help you restore, regain, and create happiness and success on your vocal journey. Hello, everybody. Welcome back to the podcast. I am very stoked and to be completely honest, a little nervous, and I'll explain in a moment why, to have this conversation with my dear friend, Clinton. Clinton is a multidisciplinary performer and educator living in New York City with his husband and miniature poodle. Clinton's decade-long career in musical theater spans from performing on Broadway and national tours to becoming an accomplished music director and choreographer, creating award-winning dance theater pieces and supporting the development of new works in New York City. Clinton studied musical theater and dance at Millikan University and went on to earn an MFA in musical theater from San Diego State University. Clinton first began developing what has become a career's work in understanding and disrupting the harmful and far-reaching consequences that some artist education spaces can have on young artists. Clinton's graduate thesis, The Ego and the Educator, was the catalyst that has led to Clinton's ongoing research and practice and in anti-oppressive facilitation, as well as, of course, the conversation that we're having today on the podcast. Currently, Clinton teaches private voice to BFA musical theater students at Pace University. They also work alongside former podcast guests Joey Harrell and Jared Trudeau at Broadway Vox, where Clinton teaches dance and voice to students and working professionals here in New York. So, Clinton, welcome to the podcast. I'm so thrilled to have you here and have this conversation, my friend. Thank you being here.
Yes, hi. Thank you for having me.
Yeah, I would love to start before we dive into the topic of the ego and the educator, of hearing your journey into becoming a performer and an artist, and then your kind of shift into directing choreography and teaching and education.
Yes, I have a winding road journey. My family and I, we moved a bunch growing up, and that has had a big influence on who I am. We moved like 20 something times. And so I've lived all over the country, went to a bunch of different schools, and had to make fast friends. And I made friends through the arts, through choir and through dancing. And that's where I fell in love with the arts. And in high school, I was like, I don't know what I should do with college. And my show choir teacher, Gail Hart, shout out, she was like, oh, you have to go do musical theater. And I was like, oh, I think you're right. So I went to undergrad, and in real Clinton fashion, I changed my major every year. I did dance. I did commercial pop music writing. But I ended up finishing musical theater. And then I jumped right into my performing career, jumping around regionally, tours, Cats and West Side, and made it to Book of Mormon. I started with Book of Mormon here in New York City, and then I ended up being the cover for all of the companies, the one here and the two tours. I take a lot of pride in my history as a swing. I think it's a part of my like all-encompassing. I'm interested in all the parts of musical theater. And then I was ready to make a shift and become a teacher more prominently, and so started teaching professional voice here in the city, started to be a music director at some colleges, And then I went and got my grad degree at San Diego State. And that is where I started my work on my thesis, The Ego and the Educator, really.
Yeah. Yeah, I'm going to come back and highlight being a swing, because I could literally do a whole episode on being a swing, although I think that most of the listeners that actually listen to this podcast know what that entails and know that that is one of the most challenging and unrewarding roles in the theater, and yet one of the most rewarding, and not everybody could be a swing. So the fact that Broadway could not run without its swings is truth, and more emphasis needs to be placed on how important those roles are in a company, because swinging is very challenging. Not only do you have to go on, because I have been alongside you with swinging, and not only do you have to be ready at the drop of a hat to go on at any time, but you have to step into roles that people are getting to do night after night after night, and you're just having to be, as you know, hopefully as strong or as great of a performance. And without anyone knowing that you haven't been performing it night after night after night after night. So a huge shout out to the swings in the industry. We would not be able to do it without you.
Yes, go Swing Nation.
Oh my gosh. Okay, so coming into The Ego and the Educator, and to the listeners, that is why I said at the beginning that I'm a little scared. I don't normally admit that at the beginning of a podcast. This conversation is a little bit more vulnerable, I think, for both Clinton and I, because we have been recipients of some of what we're going to be talking about. And I'm blown away by the amount of people that I work with, both in clinic as well as my friendships, that have gone through this exact same thing. So how have all of us gone through this? How do some people continue to go through this? And how can we create change so that this isn't happening? And part of what I'm obviously what I'm referring to here is, you know, at a very young age, hearing that you don't have what it takes, or that you can't sing, or that you are not good enough, or whatever the case may be. So what first made you decide to write your thesis on Ego and the Educator?
I think it was a combination of two things. I think it was my past experience of having educators in my life tell me that I'm not good enough, I'm not capable, I shouldn't pursue, in many forms of those words. And I think that's the big commonality I think a lot of our listeners are going to be able to vibrate with, resonate with. So my history of that experience, in combination the timing with knowing that I want to become the best educator that I can. So it was sort of my need to reflect back on who have I had as examples of educators in my life? What has that felt like? How has that turned out? And just like with our work with trying to dismantle some of the systems in our culture at large, I found that a lot of the work is awareness first. Can I point at a thing that a teacher did? Can I look at it? And then how did it make me feel? And then do I want to use that tool or not? Do I want to further those traditions as an educator, or do I want to disrupt those and make it my own version? And that's why my thesis was sort of my playground at grad school.
Mm-hmm. I think this is obviously true for education anywhere, but certainly when we're talking about the voice and along someone's entire journey. I know part of what brought us to have this conversation a few weeks ago when we were having dinner together was that I know someone who is older. They are not a young artist, and was working with someone who apparently is a, quote, wonderful voice teacher with tons of followers on social media, and was continuously kind of broken down by this teacher. And this is, you know, someone very much in their later years of life, and finally realized, like, this is not a healthy learning relationship for me, and to be able to step away from that. And I think part of her ability to step away from that was that she is a little older, and she is able to say, like, okay, this isn't working. But it took several months. Mm-hmm. So, you know, I often say to educators and to voice teachers who have a desire to work with younger demographics, like high school for voice, I keep saying, this is, you are some of the most important educators, because not only are you creating the foundation for someone's pedagogy and their technique, but you are also creating the foundation of how to be spoken to, how someone's speaking to you. Yes. And that is incredibly profound and a little scary, because mm-hmm. you're working with such beautiful, wonderful innocence, and you want to help them to jump in and believe in their dreams, and that those dreams can become goals and are approachable and a destination that they could have the ability to get to.
That's right. I think I do sort of put my high school and college students in the same sort of bubble. I know there is a little bit of a shift once you leave home and you're in a new place where you can kind of do what you want with your college friends. But I think sort of as like a developing human, there's a lot of commonalities, and I try not to take that for granted at all. I do see when I'm working with my young artists at Pace and at the other universities I've done, you're still a little human. You're still figuring out who you are and what does it mean to practice, and what do you want to create with your art, and what inspires you with your art, and why are you here? What is the joy you're chasing? What is the, like, all of those things I think are just so precious and so important. And I think if unchecked, it's easy to squash or cause harm or confuse those young people and really misdirect them, either intentionally or unintentionally as the teacher. Yeah,
I think that is definitely true about as someone goes off to university, because you're also learning to live by yourself. Mm-hmm. So not only have you been kind of separated from whatever you have come from before, but then all of a sudden, if something starts happening, I was very open about my freshman year of college on the very first episode I did on the podcast, and that going back later, I was able to have a conversation with that voice teacher and kind of rekindle a relationship. But during, I was not. And to be completely torn down, I mean, I did get to the point where I didn't even want to call my family. Like, I just didn't want to talk to anyone. Because if you're hearing that your voice is not good, there are so many levels in which your brain hears that. Mm-hmm. So, you know, a huge thing right now might be, what about some of the conditions that end up happening later on in life? Because someone felt like their voice wasn't good, or they couldn't voice. And I don't mean voice technique in this sense. I mean voice as an individual.
Yes.
They couldn't actually speak their mind, their opinion, and therefore found a way to hold that in and constrict that in. And so what might happen later in life, and I don't know that we know that, but potentially some things with spasmodic dysphonia, some things with potential paresis, some things with maybe tremors, some things with how constricted the voice gets and how stiff the cords get through hormone changes. And, you know, could that emotional impact have an effect down the line for someone who is experiencing emotions that their voice doesn't deserve to be heard?
Yeah. Yes, I think one of the clear examples in my head is Adele was interviewed around her, like, I think 21 album coming out, and they were like, how do you make all these sounds? How do you sing like this? She was like, I'm not going to do an Adele impression, but she said, no one told me to shut up when I was growing up. When I was growing up, no one told me to be quiet or shut up. And so I hear her noises and I go, wow, that makes sense. You're letting that noise is connected to your emotional core. That's just flying out. And yes, our body grows and develops, but like you said, our emotional status, our emotional freedom to react, to create the emotion from inside out changes depending on our circumstances of growth, our educators, all of that. Yes. And so moments of slight harm, microaggression, all the way to severe trauma can affect the voice and change how people allow their voice to represent who they are day to day, or allow their voice to represent their art. And I think there's so much care to be taken in there.
So much care. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. I turned my mic off because it started pouring. So let me know if you can hear, if you can hear me or cannot hear me. It either is because of my mic or because of the sound of the rain. So when you were writing your thesis, what were some of the maybe lessons learned through writing it, or just aha moments for you as you were writing it?
It is inherently tied into the time at which I was writing it, which was during the pandemic, which was during our great, most recent social reckoning with all of our systems of oppression. So that was inherently tied into how this was showing up for me. And I am a pattern kid. I'm a puzzle kid. I do the New York Times crossword every day. I love puzzles. I sort of look at my teaching as a puzzle, like a crafty puzzle. And this linking idea I got from Adrienne Marie Brown. She was one of my main sources in writing The Ego and the Educator. She's this incredible thought leader, activist. One of the tools she uses is fractal thinking. This idea of the fractal, that the big is the small. The atom is the same as the universe. And so if I'm learning about these large systems at play and how oppression and tradition and etiquette show up, I try to use that fractal idea. How is that showing up in the classroom? How are the teachers in the classroom using systems, and is it helpful or not? Yeah. One of the big ideas that showed up for me was that teaching is a craft. It is, for me, facilitation. So Adrienne Marie Brown's fractal, and Paulo Freire, his idea of the of oppression, not the banking system. So that was a big idea that I had to take out of my head. The banking system of, like, the teacher knows everything, the teacher is going to give me the answer, and then I will be fabulous. That does not work for me. Instead, it is collective problem solving. So the one of the big tools that I got out of my research was, when I am leading a classroom, either a one-on-one lesson or a full classroom, I always try to put the problem in front of us, put the tools around it, and everyone can use the tools to engage with the problem. Mm-hmm. So then it becomes less about me and more about how all these young artists are trying to grow. How are they engaging with tools? How are those tools helping them towards their goal, not the goal I'm trying to make for them? That was, like, one of my big things that I still use today.
That Something in that made me think about, and you might be taught this too. I'm not sure what they teach in vocal education, but in therapy, we talk about transference and countertransference. Do they teach that? And I'm going to probably butcher this. So therapists out there, transference is when a client comes into a space and sort of starts seeing the therapist as someone who is of not just like, oh, they know everything, I don't know anything, but it gets more personal, where it's like, oh, they, without, you know, consciously knowing it, might start seeing their therapist as their mother figure, or as their sister figure, or, you know, something like that. And then countertransference is when the therapist starts seeing the client as such, where then you're treating that student as if they are your child, or, you know, your brother, or your whatever.
Yes. I understand that as paternalism. And that being like one of like a traditional tenet in education, that like, I'm older, so I know better, so I'm going to tell you what to do, and I don't have to tell you why. It's just this. That's a sort of a crude version of it. But yes, I read that as paternalism, and I have worked to strip paternalism from my facilitation skills.
I mean, the truth is that, and I don't work with the same demographic, with younger kiddos, but we're learning from each other all the time, regardless of, that's the beauty I found in being a therapist, that as soon as I graduated from massage school, all of a sudden, my teachers who had been teaching me all along suddenly became colleagues, and they felt that way. They didn't continue to be like, well, I know more because I've done this for 26 years. It was like, what can I learn from you? And what can you learn from me? Yes. And how can we make each other better? Now, I know that I happen to be surrounded by wonderful therapists, and I'm grateful for that. I'm not sure that that's everyone's experience, but it was certainly mine, which I'm grateful for, because my wonderful colleague, Michael Alicia, who runs the clinic that I work at, just always opened up that kind of space for us therapists. And things kind of trickle down sometimes from the top, how behaviors are going to be, which will lead me into another university thing, where if something's happening with how the dean of the music school sees something, and then that trickles into the behavior of the voice teachers, and maybe they have some, you know, dueling happening where they don't like the other studios, they don't like the other teachers, what those teachers are teaching are wrong, it's not good pedagogy, and then they start to have this kind of bicker back and forth, and then that can start to trickle down into the artists who are in those studios, who start to feel the tension between what's happening with their students, and then they're like, well, that, you know, that teacher doesn't teach well, and those students aren't learning anything, and then there's something between the students and what they're feeling about their friends, other artists, their colleagues, people who they will be on stage with. And it can be this trickle down of that oppression.
I definitely see that. And I actively work to just get different perspective on that. An anecdote, this past semester, I had a student come in. We worked on the song. We were excited about it. A different person in the university said, that doesn't work for this. And so I said, instead of going, that person's wrong, listen to me, this is the thing, instead I made it, I would love for you to weigh which opinion serves you towards your goal more. I don't care if you think I'm right or wrong. What I want you to do is engage with your agency and your artistry, like which feels better for you, which feels useful. And that is its own little microcosm for the business. You're going to audition for one casting director who's going to say, I don't like that song. the next day I bring it in and someone goes, I love this song. So it's definitely not a rarity, it's a similarity. And so how we engage with that is the, I think, the tool.
I think that is such a wonderful way of bringing it in. And you mentioned agency, and to be able to encourage an artist to step into what they are wanting and start to understand, especially at that age, like, what do I want? What kind of roles do I see myself doing? What do I feel capable of? What could I dream that maybe I don't feel like I'm capable of now? And how can I meet that goal, as opposed to being told, this is what, you know, this is what you're singing this semester, this is what you're singing next semester, this is what you're singing in a year, this is what you're singing in. I mean, and I know that some of that is working on technique.
Absolutely.
There's certainly that component to it of like bringing in certain songs to work on a technique, whether or not the artist performs that or not. But from a different lens of coming in as artists come in to do movement, and it's like, sometimes it's like, I don't know, like, tell me what to do. Like, I'm just used to people telling me what to do.
Yes.
I just had this wonderful conversation with my friend yesterday of being able to say, like, what do you feel like you need in your body right now? And how can I help you achieve that? So that they, instead of looking to one more person to tell them what to do, can take that and decide it for themselves.
Yes. I think that is so important. I think it's so important, especially because we're trying to build artists, and artists are supposed to be generative and creative and not robots. And yes, we work technique. We want you to understand your instrument, choose sounds between A, B, and C, but that's only to feed what you're trying to create.
Mm-hmm.
In this conversation about agency, I also really try to do this in the physical sense in my voice studio. So with all of my kids, well, I call you kids, I know you're not all kids, my university students, on first day of class, I know that being in a one-on-one session with a voice teacher is simply inherently intimate. Two people alone in a room, and the power dynamics that are different really make that a different experience for different people. And so on my first day with any of my new students, I say, I'm going to ask you a question, and I want you to say no.
Mm.
And they go, okay. And I say, are you comfortable with me touching you today? And they say, no. And I go, great, no physical contact today. Let's go, let's sing. And for me, that's so important, for people to practice saying no to people who have more power.
Mm-mm.
And so that's another part of like how I'm trying to, yes, give these kids agency, give these people agency over their body, over their voice. Mm-hmm. It's the opposite of oppression.
Mm-hmm. What are some ways that, and whether we're looking at working at a university, which I want to ask another question about that in just a moment, but when you're working with artists, kind of some language around to make sure, or to help at least try to not have them feel like their voice isn't good or isn't worth it, or, you know, is there a certain language or certain tools that a teacher can continue to try to develop around that you kind of learned throughout writing your thesis? And I know that's going to be our journeys for the rest of our lives, is navigating language, and because each person is an individual. But did you kind of learn any specific tools on your journey?
Definitely. I took some training sessions with an organization called AORTA, Anti-Oppressive Resource Training. And they have really, really helped my facilitation skills. From them, I learned that before we can ask people to share their artistic vulnerable choices, there's things we can do on the way to let them know that their point of view and their agency is in the room. So I try to do that with small things. With this, you know, can I touch you, say no, no, giving them that agency. But song choice, you know, if there are five songs that are going to work on the same vocal goal, I'll give them all to them. Go listen to them. Which one sparks your joy? And bring that one back. We'll work on that one. So they're getting choice there. With their midterms, I try to give them two choices always. I think it's in that they just get practice of choice. And then once they feel that they can make a choice and then tell me the choice, and then it's good because it's what we're doing, that's going to give them the space between us to also give me their other choices, to give me their other, maybe more vulnerable thoughts about what they're trying to create. So I think like building those little blocks is helpful.
Yeah, I like that, because I think also with agency and choice, you're also, because you still want your students to show up. You know, they're going to go into a world where they have to show up for rehearsal. They have to show up for the performance. They have to be there. And so I think you're still showing them through choice, which makes it exciting to be there and exciting to show up, and sometimes challenging. Like sometimes it's really challenging to show up. But you're still helping give them those tools as well.
That's right. And I think that can be the scary first step for educators, because I think sometimes we feel if I give away any power, then I'm giving away all power. And I think that's so not true. The practice is definitely give and take. I'm going to give you the agency to do this thing. And I'm going to show you, I have all this experience and past knowledge about a thing, and how do they come together? And I think that's where we find joy and growth.
Yeah.
Interdependence.
Yeah. So going back to the question I was thinking of with, I guess, predominantly university, because I feel like it can be a little bit more challenging at an institution, or maybe not. Maybe it is. I feel like in private studio, if someone's like, this isn't the right fit for me, they can just peace out, you know. But when you're in an institution, you might not really be able to peace out as easily. Mm-hmm. And there are, regardless of how hard an educator might work on their language and on their toolbox, there will be some relationships that aren't the best educator-student relationships. And that's okay.
Yes.
And that's always going to happen to all of us. Sometimes the chemistry just isn't right. What are ways to navigate that at something like a university or an institution?
I will admit I am still fresh in my university working. So I know there are people who have been doing this for, you know, over a decade at university who are going to have a wonderful perspective on this. But from my fresher time in doing this, I definitely try to use conversation, relationship, and I always try to bring in more people. If me and one person are not gelling or are miscommunicating, I will always try to bring someone in who is either maybe their academic counselor or the head of our performing program, and really triangulate the conversation at least, because that's going to decentralize myself and create more roads of communication. I think that's one of the most useful ways to go about it.
Yeah, I completely agree. I think that's a really great way to go about it. I like that answer. That was really good. I'm not sure I was expecting it, but I really like it. I've seen that, where that has worked in so many areas of my life, you know, so I think that's very helpful. For the number, I don't know if there's a way of finding any kind of statistic of the amount of artists who have heard that they are no good. Did you come across that in any of the information you found?
No. So I am currently working on, I'm currently working on a project to try to find that out. I'm creating a survey that I hope to send out to give people the opportunity to share stories about their educational artistic experience. What were examples of teachers that you appreciated, that supported you, that gave you tools? What are examples of teachers who did the opposite, who stifled you, harmed you, confused you, miscommunicated, any version of that? So I don't have the numbers for that, and I'm very interested. There are so many music and theater and dance programs in the country right now, and I'm very curious about what the people graduating have to say about that experience. Mm-hmm. As I'm building this, I have sent out sort of a test version to my close circle, and like you said at the beginning, it's so common. And I have so many friends who have stories about body shaming, limiting skills, identity labeling as a tool to, you know, repress all of these things. It's very common, which, yes, like, I know I was there. I was told many reasons. I was told I couldn't for so many. And so I feel the win from that is that for some of my close friends, we already have a trust. And so I think that their ability to tell me this was a release for them and offered some form of healing. But I do know that if this survey is sent out at large, there will be a lot of people who might engage with this, and it might bring things back up, and they might not have the tools or the space or the energy to deal with that emotion, that comeback. And so I'm attempting to work on giving tools to these people before they do the survey about ways they can center, become present, and engage with this in a healthy way. But that's so tricky. And I am not a therapist. I am not a licensed mental health professional. But I do think it's probably more common than we think.
Yeah. I did not know how common it was until I became a manual therapist and started working with artists, and then started hearing their journeys. And once I started hearing journey after, and I'm like, really? You? No, you know, you, no, you, you know, it's like, what is happening? How have all of us heard, you know, how have we all heard this? It was just remarkable how many people were coming into the space having been told something. And then, of course, if someone, and not everyone that comes into my space has anything wrong vocally. Some of them do, many of them don't. They just are coming in to help them get through 8 shows a week, or their productions, or their, you know, broadcasting, or whatever it is that they do, and they're coming in for maintenance. But for those who are coming in for assistance with rehabilitation, then there's a whole nother layer of it happened because I'm not good. And which is also not the case. Sure. So that adds just such another layer and opens up a little bit of perhaps what they have been told, you know, however many years ago with their
That's right. Right. How people survive harm. Mm. The ways in which people deal with the harm afterwards is as many ways as there are humans. Mm-hmm. It's like an infinite version of understanding harm, awareness on it was not your fault, and how do you grow and stand on your 2 feet. And some people, it takes longer to do that. It takes longer for some people to separate that harm from themselves, and yeah, it's tough.
Yeah, that's definitely, you know, through, we just had a loss in our family, and through really working through grief and recognizing how similar that is with grief, of how someone grieves is very different from how the person next to them grieves, and giving each person space to be able to process at the timing which is right for that person to experience and process their grief. And so similar kind of to how someone processes through their journey of whether they're, you know, big T or small T traumas, how we process through those are very different per person. So
that's right. Yeah. That's right. In part of my other continued research and growth as an educator, I did resilience training, very intro basic resilience training, but combining that with social emotional learning tools has helped me give space for people for their own healing. Mm. It is not required. It is not a part of what the training we're doing. But if I can incorporate skills into my facilitation for these people that allows them to heal as they grow, win-win, baby. Like, yeah. Let's go.
So, I know. Your students are so lucky that you have cared enough to go through these trainings.
Mm. It helps me too.
And that you love the work and want to be the best that you can be. And that shows up. That shows in the things that you've done in order to be the best educator that you can be.
Thank you. I am dreaming. I am trying to envision the best version of my educator. And I'm trying to work towards that.
Yeah. I know we talked a little bit before we started recording on how even our best intentions sometimes go awry. So I am currently in a program where we offer case studies and heard from a very trusted, amazing, wonderful friend and colleague this week. Some of the negative abusive components of what it's like to stand in front of people as they nitpick. And even though the intention is to teach teachers wonderful tools in looking at the body, and even though that is how we approach it, have often approached it thus far in the therapeutic industry of, you know, in our training programs of looking at someone and nitpicking and, you know, this is going on and 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 this is going on. What that's like to stand in front of, especially when you have sung. So to have that realization and to have this wonderful, again, amazing, beautiful friend of mine be able to feel open and secure enough in my space and with me to share that feedback, because that is not easy feedback to give. It's like, that kind of sucked for me, you know, like that's not easy feedback to give. No is not easy feedback to give.
Mm-hmm.
I myself have made mistakes as an educator and as a therapist, but I will continue to, though I am going to work my darndest to not, it will inevitably happen. But when it does happen, have we created a space where someone feels secure enough to walk in and say, that wasn't the healthiest choice for me? And in the future, could something be modified so that that isn't someone's experience?
Mm-hmm. I think two things, that this conversation didn't happen with you by accident. I think you build trust with people you are in a space with. I think your presence and your truth and your pace allows people to be open with you. So I think you are a part of how that happened. And this person knew themselves well enough to be able to, one, recognize that harm was done, and to how it was done and felt okay enough to, yes, name it and share that. I think that feedback is a gift, mm-hmm. and doesn't happen often. And I trust you with that gift. Yes. Mm-hmm. I trust you to learn from it and mm-hmm. keep going.
Yeah. And I think to know that, yes, we will make mistakes, even when our heart is in the absolute right place. And, you know, when we're striving and thriving to be the best that we can be and the best educators that we can be, that sometimes part of that, and not sometimes, I mean, a big part of that is trying to create a space where someone feels like they can open up and say something like that to us. And so I agree. I think it was such a gift. And I'm so grateful for the friendship and the ability of this person to be able to open up about this. And for me to be able to be a little humbled by it and say, yeah, like I'm not perfect either. You know, none of us are, and we're all learning and we're on this learning journey together. And, you know, the major goal is to continue to, one, be the best that we can be and help others be the best that they can be. And to try to do that in a way that will continue to support and nurture and bring light and confidence into, you know, the next generations.
Beautiful. I could not agree more.
Yeah. Well, Clinton, thank you so much for coming on and having this conversation with me. As you know, I always just adore seeing you. I say every time I see you, I'm like, Clinton!
Same. You are. Yeah. I come home and I tell my husband, babe, I had time with Christine today. Just joy. Thank you for all of your work.
Yeah, thank you. Thank you for yours and for your continued just desire to grow for yourself, for your students, and for the industry. So may all of us continue to thrive to be the best that we can be for those that we work with. Yes. Yeah, thanks, Clinton.
Thank you.
Thank you all for listening. If you enjoyed this podcast, tell your colleagues, students, and friends. Subscribe, rate, and please write a review. You can find us on Instagram or Facebook, and feel free to check out my website at www.thevisceralvoice.com for information on programs and upcoming events. I hope you join us next time for another wonderful conversation on The Visceral Voice.